AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
This is your moment. Your time to shine. Your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Welcome, welcome, welcome back to the Bob Lefsetz podcast. I'm here down under with the legendary Peter Garrett. Peter.
Hi, Bob.
Well, let me ask you a question. If people call you Pete, is that fine, or are you definitely a Peter?
No, I take either. I'm an Aussie, so we're pretty easy about those things.
Well, you know, I'm Robert. I was never called Robert.
No.
I've been Bob from like day one. Okay, so what are we going to do about climate change?
Well, a bunch of different things. The first one would be to make sure that we have an economic instrument in every economy. The best way we can fix it quickly is to put a penalty on carbon pollution. So that's like a carbon tax. Use the money that you get from the carbon tax to essentially recycle dollars into zero emissions technologies, renewables, energy efficiency, the new stuff, the hydrogen cells and the like that are going to make the world continue to go without putting more greenhouse gas into the atmosphere. Do it in a way which essentially encourages first mover companies and innovators to do their job well, and those who are going to dig their heels in and don't want to change and are essentially writing a suicide note for subsequent generations, pay the price.
Okay, let's be very specific. The day we're recording this, Trump says he's pulling out of the Paris Accords.
Yeah.
That plan sounds great, but in the world we live in, can we enact that plan?
Well, I think we can, and I think the fact that Trump's pulling out is in some ways not unexpected, but it is not fatal to the Paris Accords essentially being the next big stepping stone to the world community reducing emissions. There's a couple of technical and political issues in the Paris Accords which are challenging. One is that up to now, countries are simply pledging, they're not promising, to enact their reductions in legislation or, you know, by a mandate or a fiat or a regulation or whatever. That has to happen. And the second thing is that from what the science is telling us, even if those countries who've already made commitments, say, for example, to reduce their emissions down to a certain figure in the next 20 or 30 years, unless they all do it, unless we all do it, then the chances of us holding warming to a level that makes the planet habitable become less. So I think what's going to happen is that when they next go, the countries next go to the Conference of the Parties, as it's called, America will still probably be an observer, even if they're talking about pulling out. Those countries that have committed to do it, mainly the European countries, China, India in particular, and the South American bloc will have more information in front of them saying, you know what, we need to accelerate reductions. So we can't go in with a business as usual, let's play around at the edges approach. We will have to do more. Some countries will then make specific additional commitments. As they do that, the pressure then comes on bad neighbours to follow suit. And of course, the outliers are countries particularly like Saudi Arabia and Russia, who aren't playing ball at this point in time.
Okay, what will be the incentive to the people to become more aggressive?
I think there are two. One is that the cost of inaction on dealing with climate change is rising exponentially, whether it's insurance costs, infrastructure destruction, population movements, effects on agriculture. I mean, look at your home state now as we speak. I mean,
California, right?
Yeah, California. I mean, like seriously, becoming an extremely difficult place to live in because of wildfire, et cetera. And that, whilst maybe not necessarily each time caused by climate change, certainly global warming intensifies wildfires as it does a whole bunch of other things. So that's the first incentive, is economies aren't going to be able to pay easily, particularly economies that are in debt, which many world economies are, for all of the infrastructure repair, emergency services and the like. So that's the first incentive. The second incentive is that if we're serious about a future for our kids, then we have to be able to envisage a future where they've still got jobs, they've still got opportunities. And of course, all of those are in the new technologies, in the new areas of low emissions, solar, wind, energy efficiency, electric cars. I mean, you name it, there's a whole world of a zero economy out there for us, but we need to get going on it.
So you're optimistic?
Yes, I'm optimistic, although I've been in this issue on and off for many, many years, Bob, and I think the current political developments, particularly in your country, but in others where you have rogue right-wing governments who either don't believe in it or don't want to do anything about it, makes it more difficult. And additionally, I think in many cases, industry, particularly the fossil fuel industries, the oil and gas companies and others, have really played hardball with this issue and are deeply culpable for knowing, as the tobacco companies did 30 or 40 or 50 years ago, that what they were doing was imperiling the planet, but not being prepared to scale back their activity. So I see the most recent amount of citizens' activities in different countries, including ours, and more so in Europe, perhaps in yours, but also in yours, Extinction Rebellion, this grassroots movement that's starting to build. I see that as part of a new response to people being absolutely frustrated that we're not getting enough done. And on the other side, the potential for social democrat parties eventually to reclaim some ground and enact things like a Green New Deal type thing, which you've seen in your country.
Well, it's interesting because Greta Thunberg has been put down by all the right wing. It shows the power of one individual.
Oh, amazing.
It's just, you know, people are playing in the background. It's just like one rock performer, one band can make such a difference.
Yes.
So how'd you become so politicized to begin with?
Oh, gee, I don't know. That's the way I am as a person.
No. Let's go back to the beginning. You and I are the same age. I'm trying to think whether I'm here with an erudite man, whether that should be you and me. But in any event, okay, you grew up where?
So I grew up in a suburb of Sydney, which is the biggest city in Australia on the East Coast. And I grew up basically in a middle class
environment. Well, a little bit slower. How many generations has your family been in Australia?
So on my mum's side, four. And on my dad, four. And on my dad's side, I think three or four.
And do you have any idea where they came from and what their incentive was?
Yes, I do. So on my mum's side, they come from the United Kingdom, from England. Excuse me. And on my dad's side, they come from Belgium and the United Kingdom.
And do you have any idea why they came?
Yes, we know that they came looking for a better life, as most immigrants do, and that when they arrived on my dad's side, they were very involved in politics, actually, as it turned out, and business and sport and all of those things. Unfortunately, on the wrong side, on the right-wing side. But Yeah, so I'm not from convict stock in Australia, and obviously our Aboriginal and Islander people are the first Australians, but I'm a generational Australian, if you like.
Okay, so you grew up in a suburb. Your parents work outside the home?
Yeah, so my dad is a business manager.
What is that in English?
That's like sort of a managing director of a company, but a big German company, but the Sydney office.
So what was the company?
They used to make tapes, BASF.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so.
They made the first chrome tapes, if you remember.
Absolutely.
Cassettes.
I know. Wow, cassettes. Love to talk about them. And my mum was, who was a big influence on me, actually, was one of the first generations of women here in Australia to graduate from university. It was at the end of World War II. Of course, many men had lost their lives. Women had gone into the workforce. They were working in factories.
Okay, I'm from America. So, yeah. We're completely uneducated. What was Australia's role in World War II?
So in World War II, we were basically followed the English into the war. And in the middle of the war, after Pearl Harbor was bombed by the Japanese, we, of course, were on the same side as you were, the Americans. And it was during that time, in early 1940s, that as a colony, which is previously what the country had been, a British colony, we pivoted, to use an Obama term. And our Prime Minister at the time said, you know, up to this point in time, we've been an English colony and we love the Queen and all of that, but we are now going to become close friends with America and Americans, and we need to because our survival depends on it. And we fought with the Americans against the Japanese as they proceeded to get closer and closer to Australia. I mean, Japanese actually bombed not only Pearl Harbor, but Darwin, a city to the north of Australia, and sent submarines down this side. The country was never physically invaded.
And was your father in the war?
No, my father wasn't, actually. He was very unwell. In fact, he unfortunately suffered ill health for most of his life. But my mother was. So she served in the Women's Air Force Regiment, and along with many other young women, when they were discharged or demobilized at the end of the war, they went to university. And so she became a social worker. And
but before you get there, her family.
Yes.
Did her father go to university?
Her father was a dentist.
Okay, so he was a professional.
Yeah, he was a professional.
And he would probably feel positive about her going to university.
Yeah, I imagine so, although I think in those days they were still pushing the boat out a little bit to do those things. First generation, really,
right.
When you think about it. 1947, probably.
So your mother's a social worker.
Correct.
And working with who?
So working with poor people.
Okay.
The underclass.
Paid by the government?
Correct. So she actually was the first social worker to be employed here in Sydney, the city that we're in, the one with the Harbour Bridge and the Opera House, and to establish what was essentially a community centre in a working class area down by the docks, which had many retired seamen, merchant seamen, who'd been at sea and who'd done this, that and the other and then who'd retired. And they built community centres, of which there are now many in Australia, and it's really an opportunity for older people just to come. They play cards. They'd have sing-alongs on Friday. I'd come down from my school and sing, you know, It's a Long Way to Tipperary or you know, all those old songs to these people. And she did that for a while. And then she moved further up the food chain. So she became a senior social worker in a big mental hospital here and basically working in the areas of health and aged care.
So how did your parents meet?
They met on the North Shore of Sydney, which is the area that we come from. Where mutual friends gathered at a boarding house. In those days, young people, when they left home, didn't go off and, you know, share flats or houses or things like that.
Right.
That they would go to a boarding house, which was run by, you know, somebody, an older
right.
couple or whatever. There were a couple of spinster aunts that ran a really nice old-fashioned boarding house out in the suburbs. And, of course, the men could visit the girls that were in the boarding house or the boys could visit the girls, but only, you know, for between 6 and 8, and they'd have to sip tea while they were watched over by some martinet. But that's – anyway, they met up there.
Oh, so they just bumped into each other and someone set them up?
Look, I don't know the full story, yeah.
So your mother didn't used to talk about the good old days?
Not really, no.
Okay, so how many kids in your family?
So on their side or on my side?
On your side.
So I'm the eldest of three boys. So,
okay.
Yeah.
And the other two are how much younger?
So 5 years to my next brother who lives in Brisbane, and then another 3 years to the youngest brother.
Okay. And a lot of times the oldest kid has a lot of pressure on them, but is also the favorite. What was it like being the oldest boy?
Look, I think I conform, you know, pretty much to the letter to the responsible eldest child. Look, I actually had a very happy childhood. My mum and dad passed away in my late teens, but up to that point in time, I never had that inter sort of parent to kid tension that quite often arrives. I think I enjoyed taking on extra responsibilities as a kid and looking after my younger brothers, which I did. And both my parents worked, so they were quite often away a lot.
Okay, so you didn't test the limits, or your parents were very, you know, lenient?
I don't think they were so much lenient. I didn't test the limits. I wasn't interested in it. It seemed to me to be completely unnecessary. I loved being a kid. And from my perspective when I was a kid is that I didn't want to grow up. I could see the responsibilities that adults had, and I thought that there's plenty of time for that to happen later on. And I still feel this even more strongly now, today, that we deny children and young people the opportunity just to have those wonderful, open, almost aimless periods of in their life where they're not under social pressure, they're not trying to meet somebody, they're not trying to, you know, start their career.
Well, you know,
or
it's kind of weird because now if someone says they're bored, you know, I don't know what world they're living in. There's so much input. But certainly in America, as a result of income inequality, the elite, so to speak, are so busy scheduling their children, trying to get them in a better educational system that they don't even fare for themselves. The other thing, of course, is the fear. I mean, I would come home from school, I change into my play clothes, I go off on my bike, and that would be it.
Exactly, same.
No concept of a play date.
No.
Okay, so how old were you? Well, how did your parents pass away?
So my dad basically had a big asthma attack. He worked pretty hard, and when I was 17, and then 4 years later, our family home burnt down, and my mum was in the family home at the time, and she perished.
You know, it's hard to have a response to that. So your father dies at 17. Doesn't that mess with the family's economics?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, it's an interesting story, Bob, because I think like most parents, he wanted the best for his kids.
Right.
One of the things he wanted to do was to send us to, you know, a good school, in inverted commas. So he worked extra hard to enable us to do that. But in so doing, I think he put his already not too good health at jeopardy. But my mum was a successful professional by that stage. So, you know, even once he died, she was able to support us. And by that stage, I'd left home and gone to university. So,
okay.
And my two brothers were still at home.
And then your mother dies tragically.
Yes.
And then you're an orphan.
Correct.
So what's that like?
Well, I mean, at the time it was traumatic and an extremely difficult period for us. And it took all of us quite some time to recover from it. And I think, I mean, they were slack, you know, they didn't have insurance or anything like that. That was it. But on reflection now, when I look back on it, I think even though, of course, I terribly miss my mum and we were close, but it made us in some ways, in other ways, because we went back literally to nothing and we looked after one another. And of course, you know, I started, even though I was at uni doing law, and I'm a lawyer by professional training, but I'm really a musician and an activist. And music had started to come into my life. And so I think when I got onto stage, and one of my closest, oldest friends sort of said to me, who knew the family before, said, when you got on stage, it seemed like you definitely had to expunge some of the heart smashes that you had. But for me, it was a case of making every minute. I just knew how precious life was by that stage because I lost my mum.
Okay. So you were 23, you say, when your mother died?
Yeah, I think 22 and then or 23.
But in any event, your brothers were much younger.
That's right.
How did they manage?
Well, we all camped together. I was back in Sydney and we just got a little flat somewhere and my brother and I got a contract cleaning out taxis, did the midnight shift on taxis here in Sydney from 12 in the morning till 5 a.m. And that's what we did to survive.
How long did you do that for?
Oh, a year or two. Yeah, with other jobs as well thrown in whilst music was starting.
Okay, so let's go back to school. Were you a popular kid at school?
Yeah, look, I wouldn't have been unliked. I think reasonably popular, but I wasn't sort of head of the gang or anything like that.
Did you have friends?
Yeah, no, I had some friends.
Okay, now you're obviously a tall gentleman. How tall are you?
6'4" in socks.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what is it like? Were you tall as a young kid?
Yeah, I was tall and gawky, you know.
Okay,
so
how does that affect your personality?
Well, I think it probably means that you're a little aware of social settings. Look, I'm quiet and polite in one way. This is just the character that I have. But in another way, I'm not insecure about myself at all. And I don't think I really ever have been, even as a teenager. And I put that down to my parenting, in as much as I had parents who encouraged us. They weren't indulging us and saying, oh, aren't you fantastic, little Pete? You know, you can sing, you know, you're going to be a pop star. There's none of that. They just treat you with respect, but say, if you want to do something, you've got the potential to do it. Whatever it is you choose to do, you can do. And you get a good hearing here. And we don't judge people. We don't label people. We don't spend our time comparing ourselves against others. I never heard my parents talk about the people next door and wishing they had more or less money than them.
Listen, my parents were the exact opposite. My older sister's still traumatized by, you know, my father and mother talking about a girl in the neighborhood and how great she was, et cetera. And my mother would, you know, if I called her up and I was going to do something, you know, she would say, you know, essentially, why you? Yeah. I'm still dealing with that.
Right. It would be.
So certainly, yeah. I mean, I grew up on the eastern coast of the United States and the transistor came along and we were listening to the sports, baseball, the Yankees, and then had certain singles. Then, of course, the Beatles hit and all hell broke loose. What was it like for you being here?
Well, I can count my equanimity basically because I think I had pretty decent parenting. And my parents loved the Beatles. So
your parents loved the Beatles?
Correct.
Whoa. Yeah. Let's go back to the beginning. In my house, my parents were avid music lovers, but they played the show tunes.
Yeah, right.
How about your parents?
Same.
Okay.
So, I grew up on a diet of show tunes, Crosby, Sinatra, Elvis, but they kept going. And they enjoyed parties. And so the Beatles came and that sort of first British pop invasion sort of rolled through the suburbs of Sydney and came into our living room. But by that stage as well, I had ears for music too. I did a stint at boarding school. You talk about transistors. I did a stint at boarding school. I distinctly remember having my little transistor under the pillow at night, listening to the Kinks, you know. Listening to The Who, listening to whatever.
Okay.
The Doors.
So if your parents are Beatles fans, that doesn't square with the generational revolution that we experience and people talk about, where people are fighting against their parents. Your parents, were they hipsters? Were most other people's parents like that?
I wouldn't say they were hipsters. I just think they were relatively broad-minded and open, and I think they just enjoyed music, and I think they were civil sort of people. So they weren't trying to impose their strictures and their views on their kids. They taught us good manners and, you know, how to treat other people, but it was pretty basic stuff.
So you have three kids yourself.
That's right. I have three daughters.
And how old are they?
33, 32, and 30.
Okay, well, they've been out of the house for a while.
And back.
They never leave anymore.
No, I've noticed. Okay. Yeah, I love that.
Okay, so how do you feel about their music?
Well, I think it's incredible for them because
No. It's incredible for them. How do you feel? Your parents were Beatles fans. Are you a hip-hop fan?
Yeah, I don't mind a little bit. Bits of hip-hop, yeah. I mean, I'm selective, I think, in my listening. The reason I said incredible, though, is that their palette's so much wider than mine ever was.
Of course.
It's just massively wider.
Right.
And if you listen to their playlists, you know, what they curate, it's crazy. I mean, I'm hearing stuff I never knew, but I'm also hearing things that I loved, but I thought they would never actually ever listen to.
Right. So you're in boarding school. What age do you go to boarding school?
I only did a brief stint in boarding school, but I was in boarding school when I was 15 and a half.
So what happened? Why was it brief?
My parents went away and they just stuck us in there, you know, for a period of time.
Where did they go?
So my dad had to go to work in Germany because BASF, and my mum had relatives in actually North America and Canada, so she took off as well.
So they parked you in boarding school.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks, Mum and Dad.
So how long was that for?
Oh, not very long. Six months.
Okay. So are you a record collector when you're before you go to university?
Look, I think I fall into the category of someone who loves their music a lot and who is a bit of a bowbird, but I'm not an avid collector. I'm not one of these fans. I'm not a musician who can tell you every B-side that their favorite band
made. Well, forgetting the musos.
Yeah.
When you're in the mid-60s, 64 to 70 or so, when you graduate from high school,
yeah.
Are you listening to the radio, going to shows, doing all that stuff?
No, not really going to shows. Listening to the radio and pop radio.
Right.
And just starting to get a little bit of interest. I mean, I went to a show, but I couldn't afford to go in. So I stood outside with my ear up against the brick wall to hear what was going on inside, you know.
Do you remember what show that was?
Yeah, it was a band called Tamim Shud, who were actually almost a 60s psychedelics band, surf band. But they were the big band in our area. And I was amazed.
Were you the type of guy who would dance when the music played?
At shows, no. I'm standing back and listening and trying to figure out what's going on, you know.
Okay. And are you someone who has girlfriends in that era?
Yes, but more so at university. So for me, it really came – so I left home in 70, and instead of going to university in my hometown in the city of Sydney, I essentially went to the equivalent of Washington. I went to Canberra, and we have a national university there. And I was on the college there, and it was there that but people came from all over Australia and actually from other parts of the world as well, interestingly, mainly Africa. And there was a lot of music. A lot of new music was pouring through. People were reading the New Music Express, Rolling Stone. We were seeing that explosion of music, which washed through 66 to 70 in the States in particular. San Francisco et al. Washes into Australia, 71, 72, 73.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What acts do you remember from that era?
Well, I guess to begin with, on the English side, all of the big classic acts that you and I both know, and then additionally, more widely, people like Fairport Convention, Robert Wyatt, Soft Machine, et al. On the American side, again, the classic bands of that era, but the Byrds would be the one that really sort of hits me quite hard. And I liked a lot. And then you go to the Doors, you've got the Mamas and the Papas, you've got the explosion of San Francisco bands, Moby Grape, and so on and so forth.
Okay. So was this your number one interest once you're in university, or?
I've always surfed and always enjoyed doing that. Yeah. Yeah. So
I mean, I'm an American. I don't know the I don't know the geography of Australia, but Canberra is not by the
no,
water.
No, it's not. No, correct. But I grew up here. And
right.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's something like 80% of Australians live within 50 kilometers. Of the coast.
When did you start surfing?
Oh, we all start young here. Yeah, like
so. How young were you?
4 or 5.
And yeah, do you probably still surf?
No, unfortunately, not as much as I do, but I get in the water. But the point being, I still love to surf, but I was listening to music. I was interested in, I sang in the choir at school and I sang in a few little folky things. And when I got to the university, there were always bands playing, you know, in the colleges on the weekends. And I fell in with a bunch of people who liked music. And I got a job, actually, as a volunteer on the university radio station because they didn't have anyone to sort of do the night shifts. And I've always been a nighttime person. So I started playing music on the radio at night. And then I started playing music at night in bands.
Okay. When you were on the radio, how many days a week were you on the radio?
I think 2 or 3 nights a week.
Okay. Yeah. What would you play?
Well, the whole side of, you know, Adam Hart Mother by Pink Floyd.
You know, I bought that. I never really got into it, but whatever.
I'm a gummer.
Another one I bought.
Yeah.
Okay, so at what point do you say, shit, I could be a performer?
Well, two points, really. The first is that there was, so I had some mates and they had a band and they were writing songs or trying to and they were running around and I went to see them. Because I had a truck driving license and I was driving trucks as well.
Whoa. Stop for a second. Let's go back here. Yeah. You say you're trained in law. You know, every country is different.
Yeah.
That means if you and me, if I, you know, smashed a window here, could you defend me in court?
Well, I could. Yeah. I mean,
Are you licensed to do that?
No, not at this point in time. No, I've let that pass over the years.
Okay, but at one time you were licensed.
At one time, I had gone and passed my barrister's admission exam, okay. So I could have appeared for you in a court.
Okay. What was your drive to be an attorney?
I think partly that I couldn't think of anything else I could do where I could talk, you know, that this is a talking job and I'm not mathematically or technically minded. And as I got a little older, I realized that the legal system was pretty important. I studied air and space law and penology, which is the law of prisons and criminals. And I thought I'd go to the bar, potentially, or I'd work in the international field in the area of space law and international agreements and things like
now,
that.
Now, in America, you go to college for 4 years, then you go to law school for 3 years. How does it work in Australia?
Yeah, so we don't have a college system here. You go straight to university, essentially, when you finished high school. And the law degree will take you 4 years if you do it by itself. I actually did an arts degree in politics as well, so a double degree. So that's by the time you're done, it's 6 years.
Okay. Yeah. And then you have an exam, but you know, for law.
Yes.
But you never practiced law?
I practiced very briefly, yeah. So
Just like me.
Yeah, yeah. No, we're quite similar.
how briefly did you practice?
6 months.
And what kind of law did you practice then?
I was providing advice to companies about the different laws in different states. Australia is a federation. So
I know nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's okay. A federation means what?
Yeah, a bit like Canada. So when Australia was first occupied by the British, they occupied it state by state.
Okay.
And they constituted laws in each of those states. And the country didn't come together as a whole nation until 1901, even though the English had been here since the mid-1770s and early 1800s. So the states had to agree to become a federated nation. And they've all got different laws. The states do their own thing still to this day. So it was very dry, very boring stuff, and I quickly left.
Okay, but were you working for yourself? How were you getting
the
work?
Yeah, working for myself.
How did you get the work?
I think a solicitor who had been at law school with me said, oh, look, these companies need to know what they can do with their labeling. Do you want to have a go at it? And I said, yeah, sure.
Okay. Did you quit because music was becoming successful or because you just couldn't stand doing it?
No, I did it I didn't do it for very long. I didn't mind it. But by that stage, I'd met Rob Hurst and Jim Magini who had started a band at school, really, and had started writing songs. And we had become Midnight Oil by that point. And we agreed that if we were going to do anything with it, then we would stop what we were doing otherwise and just throw ourselves out full time.
Let's go back to the earlier story. You were a truck driver?
Yeah, look, so I drove trucks in my dad's company when I was
like how big
last year of school.
Like how big a truck?
Not a massive semi-trailers, okay. But the next one's down.
Okay.
And I kept that license. And when I was at university, in the National University, I pay my way through. And of course, by this stage, my dad's passed away, and then I wanted to not be a drain on my mum. So I used to work on the weekends driving trucks, and then I actually took a year off where I'd worked for a big trucking company just to pay off debts and sort out money. And I started because I had the truck driving license. Of course, I was the guy that could be the roadie.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and big and strong in those days. So I was loading the boxes in and out and helping these people.
Right, just so I know.
Yeah.
Usually, I would think of a trucking company. You drive there, you drop off your car, you drive, you leave the truck back. How did you have the truck to work for
BS? They used to let us have the truck,
okay,
which was quite novel in those days. I'm sure it wouldn't happen today.
right.
Especially if they knew what was happening to it. But I heard the band, and I liked it, and I was listening to lots of music and playing music at night in the college station. But the singer wasn't really that good, and I said something like, look, they said, how are we going? And I said, well, not too bad, but singers maybe. Well, classic Australian response. Oh, I suppose you could do better.
Right.
And I said, yeah, I'm sure I could.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of. A degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward.
You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Okay, wait, two things. How long were you schlepping the gear before this conversation?
Not very long.
Okay. And did you say the singer was bad because in your heart you knew you wanted the gig?
No, I didn't actually think I'd end up singing with them at all. They just asked me the question. I just answered it honestly.
Okay, then what happened?
Then they said, well, do you want to come along and sing? I said, yeah, sure, I'll do that, which I did. So we were a university band made up mainly of students, and we were not very good. We were playing covers. We were playing a lot of rock and roll. We were playing, you know, Roadhouse Blues, Stone songs and so on. But eventually we also had a fellow that came to join us who was someone who got onto synthesizers very early on, who was a huge fan of Eno's, as it turned out. And he'd built for himself a little primitive noise generator. So we used to play rock and roll with synthesizers going on in the background. And we just toured relentlessly in and around Canberra, but only on the weekends.
Okay. You have a unique vocal style. Were you singing in that style when you were doing covers?
Probably, but probably not very, very well, but yeah,
okay.
The same style.
Okay, just what is the Australian personality? Because you're self-deprecating. Is that because of your success or is that Australians?
I think it's partly Australians. We tend not to blow our own trumpet too. That's changing a little bit. You do get people that blow their trumpets a bit louder now, but I think it's part of our national culture to some extent, but it's probably also part of my nature. I'm not... I don't know what it is, but I tend not to want to shout too loudly about what I'm doing. I mean, I'm proud of what I do, but I think it's just the way we are.
Okay, so you're playing with this band. You're talking about it in a very negative way, even though you ultimately had great success. You're playing on the weekends. What kind of gigs, what kind of money are you making?
Not much. And it's not Midnight Oil. It just comes in a second or two's time. So I'm in Canberra, we're students. And we are reliable because we had a van that worked and a PA. And we're heading off to, say, a hotel, like a pub in a country town, maybe an hour's drive from Canberra. And we're playing on a Friday night to maybe 100 or 200 people, and we're getting a couple hundred bucks to do that. We're playing at uni balls and dances. We would actually play anything, you know, play anywhere. I mean, we played out in paddocks for farmers and, you know, who would always be shouting out, you know, play AC/DC, you know, we'd have to play some more AC/DC for
okay,
them.
Okay, so what was the thought at the time? Just having a lark or was it, well, maybe this will turn into something?
For me, it was a little bit of both. Actually, such a good question because I intended to finish my law, but I actually found, I knew I would like performing and I love singing. And even though we weren't that good, it was still good fun. And we were meeting girls and, you know, carrying on and doing whatever. And I thought at the time, I love this and I understand how it works, but I don't know that it can go that far with these people, even though they were good friends. And actually what ends up happening is I go back to see my mum before she passes away and I'm up in Sydney in holidays. I'm looking for a job and normally I'd work as a labourer or a truck driver and there's an ad in the paper singer wanted for tour on the coast. And I answered the ad and showed up, and there were these younger guys in a room, but they could really play. And that was Midnight Oil, or the beginning of Midnight Oil. And so I auditioned, as it were. No one else auditioned, so I was it, and off we went.
Well, let's go back a little bit. You see the ad.
Yeah.
You must have been looking for something.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I had to work over the summer period, you know.
Well, I mean, in Los Angeles, there's a famous rag called the Recycler.
Yes, there is.
Okay, yeah. So yeah. In Australia, was it? Were there commonly ads for bands in this paper?
No, it was complete. It was one of those really strange. This is like an ad in the LA Times.
Or, okay.
Yeah. Underneath, you know, car washing and
but also, okay, if you're looking for a job for money, one doesn't necessarily think they can make that kind of money in a band.
Correct.
That, as opposed to a straight gig.
Yeah, no, that's right. But it looked like fun, and I thought, Leah, well, I should do it.
Okay, so how far away is the band from where you're living?
Well, they all are roughly the North Shore area.
So okay, so they're close.
Yeah.
You get there, you get the gig, and they had a tour book?
Yeah, they had a tour book.
How many dates?
Which they'd worked out themselves. So they were quite enterprising. I think probably about 15 or 16.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you go on the road with them.
Yes.
How long after the ad?
About 3 or 4 weeks.
Okay. Yeah. Was there rehearsal?
Yeah, yeah, lots of rehearsal.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
And you go out on the road. What was it like?
Yeah, so it was a tour during summer, in our summer season,
right,
where everybody is on the coast. So it was a tour of the coast. So we're playing in surf clubs, in hotels on the beach, in little halls on the beach. We're sleeping on the beach. And it was great fun. A little wild and woolly at times, but really good fun. But for me, I was older than they were.
How much older?
2 years maybe.
When that makes
years.
A difference.
It does at that age. And I thought, oh, that was fun. And they said, yeah, look, it's been great to have you. But I was going back to Canberra, back to the university, finished my law degree. And they were doing their own thing. They were students as well, but younger than me. And, you know, I don't think they didn't really necessarily think I was going to hang around. And so they went off to look for another singer in Sydney, and I went back to Canberra.
Okay, just to stop for a second. So if they booked the tour themselves, somebody in the band was very enterprising.
Yeah.
Who was that?
So that would have been Rob Hurst, the drummer.
It's always the drummer. That's what I was asking. I don't know why. The drummer is always the business guy.
Yeah, just say Metallica.
Okay. Okay, really. Yeah. So, but I can admit it's always the business guy.
Yeah.
So the drummer. Yeah. So you go back to Canberra, then what happens?
I do another year studying.
And you don't have any contact with the
Not
band.
At all. Very little.
And are you playing with your other band?
And, yeah. Okay. And it starts to fall apart.
Okay.
Yeah. And actually, when I get back to play with them, I think, it's not as good as it could be. And I'd been with a band that was
right,
better.
Right. You know? How can you keep them down on the farm?
Yeah, no, exactly. So at the end of that year, of course, I'm going to come back up to Sydney again to visit my mum and see my friends and so on. And so we're in touch. And they said, well, look, actually, we haven't found another singer. Do you want to come and just, you know, do some shows? And we want to keep playing. I said, yeah, sure, I'll do that. And eventually that became the genesis of Midnight Oil.
Okay. You play for the summer. Don't you have to go back to school again?
Yeah. Well, by that stage, I thought, you know what? This band really is worthwhile, you know? And I really loved what I heard. And I thought we could do something. I wasn't quite sure what it would be. So I transferred to finish my law degree up here, which is what I did.
Okay. And what happens with the band?
We rehearse at night. We start playing on the weekends. I finish my law degree. I said to them, I want to finish it and get it done. I've gone this far. I just didn't want to throw it away. And some of them had degrees as well, but they were not
lower
as long
degrees.
As mine.
Right.
So most of us finished our uni thing as we were rehearsing and writing songs and just trying to get ourselves sorted out.
Now, when you were playing in the beach the first summer, you weren't doing original material.
Very little, no.
So how did the original material come to be?
Rob Hurst and Jim Magini, who was the guitarist, keyboard player, had met at school and they started to write songs and had fiddled around writing songs and discarding songs and writing songs. And they started to bring songs in and we started to play them.
And what was your involvement?
D- To begin with, I'd say, yeah, let's see if we can sing it. And then after a while, I started throwing in ideas. And then eventually, well, Martin Rossi joins the band and we start writing together. But they're still bringing most of the ideas, the melodic ideas and the musical structures and things like
okay,
that.
Okay, so let's jump ahead. You practice law for 6 months.
If that.
If that. And then you say, okay, the band says, we're either going to throw in seriously or whatever. Yeah. But no one has any money, right?
Correct.
So what do you do for money?
Well, we just decided to play, you know, we thought, I mean, it's actually me saying, you know, at this point in life, if you're going to do anything, you've got to really throw yourself at it. You can't pretend. We can't be mucking around on the weekends. We are going to play no matter what, anywhere, anytime. If anyone will give us a dollar to play, we'll go and play, which is what we did. So we started creating our own shows. They had done some of that themselves, and I'd done that when I was at university. Like, well, why don't we play in that room over there? They don't have bands. Go and talk to the guy that runs it. It's his bar. Yeah, all right, whatever, you know. I'm not going to give you any money, but if we make, you know, $50 on the bar, you get $25, whatever it might be. You just go and do it.
Okay, how old were you at this point?
So I'm 23 at this point.
Okay, and what are you living on while this is going on?
Burgers.
Okay, and so at what point, what's the big break, so to speak, even though there's a lot of little breaks, but yeah. What is the turning point?
Well, look, I think, you know, in a career this long, Bob, there's obviously quite a few of those. So One of them is that we actually got a manager who shared the vision. A wild
Was the
guy.
Manager experienced? Or
no, not at all.
So how did you find the manager?
He found us. Yeah, he came in. We played in surf pubs. We'd started just occupying a hotel. We'd play in the corner and we'd just set up on a Friday or a Saturday night. It'd be booked. The publican was happy because people would come in and buy beer. And eventually the numbers just grew and grew and grew. And then eventually you started charging people more and more. And we'd have lines out around the block. And he was one of those people who started to come. He was a real estate agent. He was a surfer. And he said, you need a manager, which of course we did because Rob and I were doing it at that stage. And, you know, we had other things that we wanted to do. And he was crazy and wild, but he also had a great spirit of let's do something really in a very different way. In some ways, we're a very conventional band, you know. We play, we rehearse, we write songs, we use, you know, bespoke instruments. If you come and see us play live, you're going to see, you know, a performing band. But in other ways, we're completely the opposite of that. We're very different. And we essentially, no one wanted to know about us. No one wanted to, you know, Columbia, when they first heard us, passed on us, you know. They said, no, not with that guy singing. Just no way. Having a manager that did that was I think that's our first break. And our second break really is here in Australia. We have a public broadcasting network. It's a little bit like National Public Radio, right. But it's much bigger and it's run by the government, supported by the government. And they established a youth station just fortuitously at the same time as ourselves and other bands like In Excess and Men at Work and so on and so forth were just starting to emerge. And we got played. On the radio, which we never were getting played on commercial radio or FM radio. There's just no way. So we got played. So
okay, then what happened?
Crowds got bigger.
Okay, yeah. Just to be clear, once you say we're going pro, I'm giving up practicing law, and you're playing, what percentage of the material is original, what percentage is covers?
90% of it by that stage is original.
Okay.
Yeah, and we're going out to places, you know, let's just call them like a redneck tavern or something like right. that on a Tuesday night. And we're just setting up, you know, and we're playing to, you know, 50 people or 100 people or 200 people, all original material and political material too sometimes. That starts to creep in. And to begin with, audiences here in Australia, they liked the fact that we were there and I would talk a lot on stage. I'm talking to people and you're talking about what's going on in the world and politics and culture and what have you. But they didn't necessarily like the music to begin with, but we threw ourselves into it. You know, we were sort of half punks as well, so we were tearing up the stage at night and playing loud and fast and furious. And the energy of the band drew people back, and then eventually more and more people kept on coming. I mean, it's literally the classic thing, and you know many stories like this.
Okay, so what's the dream at that point?
Can we make a record? Can we actually survive off being musicians?
So you get on the youth radio station. audience to get bigger, and then what happens?
Well, we eventually we do make a record.
For who?
So we couldn't find a major that we could agree with, so...
Okay, so you had offers, but the deals were not good.
Or they wanted to change what we were doing,
right,
or whatever, and they just weren't talking our language. So we formed our own label, but it was put out by actually a television company here that actually happened to have a pressing plant. They just had acquired a pressing plant, and they were pressing country music and sort of gimmick records. So we formed a label, which we had control over.
What year were we in?
1976.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Where was the money to make the record?
They advanced us a bit of money to make it, and we had a loan from the bank. We found a bank manager, surprisingly, and this fellow is very important in Midnight Oil's history, as it would be for any band, who didn't tell his superior officers that he was loaning money, overdrafting a band. It took us about 7 years from when we first went professional to get out of debt.
Well, how much did you borrow?
Well, not a lot, maybe $100,000. But those
That's
days, a lot of money.
Back in those days.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So when you would go back to the bank manager, he would continue to give you money?
Yeah. Just honored us.
What was the pitch?
He'd been to see us and he could see the people there. You know.
Okay.
He didn't really understand anything about it, but he just knew there was something going on. And see, importantly here, unlike modern era, we've got no social media. We're not inner city darlings. We're not the culture darlings. And we're playing in the suburbs too as well. And we're hard-headed and doing it our own way, but we're not talking about it. We're not trumpeting it to anybody. We're not self-proselytizers. So it was just happening.
Okay. Who owns the record today?
We do with them.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so how many copies?
Through which we license back into
right.
Sony.
Okay. So how many copies do you press?
I think 5,000.
And do they sell?
Yes.
Sell them at the gig or in stores?
Through stores, yeah. Distributed in stores.
So if you press 5,000, you sell 5,000, you must feel pretty good about yourself.
No, absolutely. And you know, and I heard the song on the radio. I heard one of it. We didn't get anything on the charts, but of course that station, you know, we got played. And I drove home and my grandmother was still alive and I was taking her down. You know, I used to take her out on a Sunday just to have a little lunch thing and then take her back to where she was living. And I heard our song, you know, for the first time I ever heard my voice on the radio. And as far as I was concerned, I had a record. My gran could see that I was an artist who was making a living out of it. That was it. We'd made it. Anything since then has been cream.
Okay. And how long did the original manager last?
Oh, a decent time. Yeah, no, he was with us for probably 15 to 20 years.
Okay. So you put out the record independently, then what happens?
Just kept on going. More touring.
How many dates can someone play in Australia? It's a big country, but there aren't that many people here.
No, but you know, and I don't want to be nostalgic about the Australian music scene at that time, because I think it's probably a little bit the same in other countries, certainly in the States, which has got a very healthy scene in different ways. But at this point in time, for a variety of different reasons, there were a lot of places to play if you wanted to, or you created your own places to play and then essentially invited people to come and share the space with you. So we would play 150 to 200 gigs a year.
And all over the country?
All over the country. So in the big cities, driving up and down the coast, country towns, pubs, workingmen's clubs, university halls, sometimes surf clubs, and just relentlessly play and play and play.
Okay. At this point, some Australian bands, not that this even happened in the 60s, but certainly in the mid-70s, they're starting to make it on a worldwide basis.
Yes.
Do you see that as an avenue for Midnight Oil?
We always had our eye on going further than Australia, only because we realized that there's a limited number of times that you can run around the country. And we were students of music. We've all got different tastes, but you know, whatever we were listening to, was The Clash? Was it Red Hot Chili Peppers? Was it Lou Reed? It didn't matter. We were just listening to everybody. And we knew there was a bigger world out there. How that would happen and how we would make that work, I don't think we had any idea.
So what's the next step after the independent record?
Another one.
Okay.
And then another one. And then Glyn Johns comes to Australia, who formerly produced The Who and The Stones and various people.
Legendary guy.
Legendary guy. And he gets asked out here by the record companies. I think it's a music conference of some kind. And sees the band playing live in one of these big surf pubs with, you know, sweat pouring off me and a bunch of wild
young
people.
At what point do you shave your head?
Oh, that's happened long ago.
Yeah. And what was the
That wasn't really a showbiz thing particularly because I was still surfing at the time and it was just getting in the way. Also, my brother and I used to love taking going out in the water and taking in the water photography of big waves, big surf here, and the professional surfers. So we used to love going out. You know, you sometimes see them. There's the people with the flippers ducking under when the wave. So that's what we were doing. But you pop up to take the photo, and I had long hair at the time, and there'd be this wisp of hair. That's got to go.
And you literally said, "It's in my way, I'm cutting it off."
Correct.
And did you ever grow it after that?
No.
Okay. But that was when no one shaved their head.
That's right. Yeah, no one at all.
But you're that kind of iconoclastic guy who says, if everybody's going one way, I'm going a different way?
It probably didn't even enter my mind, to be honest.
Okay. So Glyn Johns sees you.
He sees us and he convinces A&M that we're worth it and says, look, come to England and record. You've got a couple of records under your belt, but I think we can do better than that. And A&M were interested in and had seen us. And I think we may have traveled once just briefly and done a few shows in London and came back with our tail between our legs. In any event, we record with Glyn. A&M pass on the album altogether. They decide they don't want to put it out.
Wait. But they paid for it.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. He goes across to LA and New York to try and shop it. And, you know, he's proud of it to his great credit. But no one's interested. So we come back to Australia. And
yeah, your ego must have been pretty crushed.
Well, no, actually. The judgment of record company people on the value of our music has never meant much to me.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I don't disrespect them and I've got some great friends in the business now, but they're always looking and hearing it through a certain prism.
Okay, so you always had confidence.
Always.
Okay, so you come back to Australia. What ultimately happens with that record?
That record's released here in Australia and it does well.
On what label?
Well, eventually on Columbia. So here in Australia, Columbia then become interested and they essentially pick up that record.
Okay.
So CBS picks it up, but there's a lot of negotiation because we want to maintain control over everything pretty much as we can. So they pick it up here and they get the opportunity to license it in other territories. We continue touring, we continue playing, but we start making little forays. We save up enough money. So we tour here, you know, work, and then head across to San Francisco or LA.
All on your own money, no label money?
Correct. Yeah, all on our own money.
Okay, so the drummer basically finds places to play there?
No, he's not doing all the business now. So Gary Morris, who manages us at that stage, our manager, and we get an agent, and we invite people to see us. And if they like the band and they want to support the band, they become part of the Midnight Oil family. And we enjoy working with people like that. And so, yeah, they find places for us to play.
Okay, so it was their idea to go to these places.
No, we wanted to go, but we wanted someone to help us.
Okay,
yeah.
So you go, you have this one album. Is it even out in other territories at that point?
Yeah, it's got limited release in other territories.
Okay, so you go to San Francisco, you go to these places.
Yeah.
What happens?
We played 150 people in a club.
And you're building an audience? Or they say, hey, though, that's nice. See you next time.
We're building an audience. It's intermittent, but we're building it. We're meeting people in the business. We met David Frick from Rolling Stone who comes to see us and people who are watching what's going on. We play colleges. Start to play a few colleges, get played a bit on college radio, but essentially still come back again.
Right.
And then we realize that we're at that junction point. You know, we need to really figure out what the next step for us can be. So we go back to London with a bunch of songs under our belt. We meet a young producer, a guy called Nick Launay, who's produced Public Image and Gang of Youth and now produces Nick Cave and various other people. And we go to the Townhouse Studios in Shepherd's Bush where lots of different people have recorded, including Phil Collins' famous big drum sound In the Air Tonight. And we really work hard to create a record, which is the 10-9-8-7-6-5-4-3-2-1 record, 10 to 1, a record which was our do or die. You know, we'd reached that point.
Who pays for it?
I can't remember the details, but I think We may have got some advance for it and we may have coughed up a bit ourselves. And we came back. That record then goes onto the Australian charts. We have a number of big radio songs here. We'd had a little bit of radio airplay before. It stays on the charts in our own country for over 2 years. And it breaks us essentially into as a mainstream artist. We become a mainstream artist essentially, even though lots of people knew about us, but it was always a cult. It was always underground, you know. And then that some of those songs get picked up mainly by college radio and some alternate
But airplay. It's out on Columbia in the States.
Correct, yeah. It's a big record for us, but it makes no indent really in other parts of the world. We then continue to make records. We keep doing what we're doing. I'm now getting increasingly drawn into political activism as well. So our career's getting a little stretched because I am now in a situation where I stand for public office here.
No, whoa, whoa, whoa.
Yeah.
Beds are burning.
It's coming.
Okay. So, yeah. Okay. So what's your motivation to go sideways and go run for political office?
Well, it was the nuclear disarmament issue, and we'd actually recorded an album after 10 to 1. We went and recorded in Japan, and after we'd finished recording, a bunch of us said, well, look, we're here. Why don't we go and have a bit of a look at the country? I went to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I saw what happened when the atomic bomb was dropped, and I thought it's crazy that we've got, you know, 30,000 of these things sitting in each of the warheads, you know, America and Russia. We can't use them. That's got to change. And there was a party that sprung up here in Australia, and I ran for the Senate. I nearly became a senator.
Okay, whoa.
Yeah.
Theoretically, if you got elected, that would put a dent in the band.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely.
So what did the rest of the band members say?
Well, you know, I think it says something about Midnight Oil. You know, we've always given one another enough space and respect to well, – they knew I wanted to do it, you know, to go where we want to go. And was the band going to fall apart? Well, no. You know, maybe they'd go off and do stuff themselves. Maybe I could join them on the weekends. We didn't really know.
Okay, just a little bit slower. What was the process of saying, of throwing your hat in the ring? At what point did you say, you know, what caused that? There's a party, et cetera.
Yeah, look, it's a small grassroots party that forms and they're looking for candidates. They had different candidates. They had a possible candidate here, but a bunch of people came to me and said, look, why don't you be our candidate? You know, 10 to 1 was a really strong record at the time. Anti-nuclear record. I'd spoken out about those things already. You're very well known, sort of.
Right.
Have a go. And I said, yeah, look, I'm more than happy to do that.
Okay, so you run. Do you go door to door? Do you really push it?
Yep, we run a – well, it's for the Senate here, so you're not campaigning as you were in, say, in a district or something like that, like a congressman or woman. We're written off by the media and the major parties as a novelty act. And belittled and criticised, but many young people particularly respond, and we start to become more and more popular. What happens next is a technical issue, but essentially in our system, parties preference other candidates when they use up their existing number of votes. And here the major parties decided not to preference me at all. So essentially, even though I got a lot of primary votes, many primary votes. I just missed out on getting into the Senate on primary votes alone and received no other votes.
Right.
So, look, I think the shorthand of it, Bob, is that it was an incredible experience and we created something quite special here. We had artists and writers and filmmakers and other musicians all involved. It was a small people's movement. And we shifted the foreign policy of the country a little bit, not as much perhaps as we would have liked, but more than we would have if we hadn't done anything. I ran the campaign, but I didn't get in, and that was a blessing for Midnight Oil and for our audience because we could resume the career.
Okay, so how do we get to the hit?
So by that stage, I have been approached to become the president of one of the big national environment organisations here in Australia. It's called the Australian Conservation Foundation, who we'd done a little bit of benefit concerts and things for in the past. And I could see through my lawyer eyes that they needed the possibility of someone to work with them. And the fellow who became their executive director, who was also a lawyer like me, had been working with Aboriginal people in the middle of this country near that big red rock, Uluru, who were about to get their land back, given back to them. It had been stolen essentially by the British, and they wanted to make a little film. And he said he called me up and called Gary up and he said, look, do you think the Orrs would write a couple of songs for this film? The traditional elders, the older people in the tribes would like them to write a song or some songs. And we said, yeah, of course, we'd love to do that. And so Dead Heart and Beds Are Burning, in their initial phases, songs that Rob Hurst brought to us in different, finished in different ways, why don't we use these songs? So we recorded Dead Heart long before we made Diesel and Dust, long before Beds Are Burning. And we said, and we sent it to them. We said, do you like it? You know, would you like to use this for your film? Yes, they would. And Beds was another song that we had, which we were mucking around with. We then thought, like, it's time to make an album. We went into the studio.
But was Beds about what it was about then?
Correct.
It still had the same subject matter.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, and potentially a song to be used for this film. A little film.
Right, I got it.
It's like American Indian people from Flagstaff, Arizona, putting together like a mini film, which two people are going to see.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global. Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
So we went into the studio.
Who's producing now?
So Warren Livesey, who had produced an English artist called The.
Right, of course.
Matt Johnson.
Right. An epic.
Yeah, an epic. Had come over to produce. And we had the songs. We had most of the songs written. And we went into Albert's studio. The AC/DC guys had a little – their publishing house had a small studio in Sydney in the Northern Beaches. And we started to record the songs, including Beds Are Burning, which once we'd finished with it, we knew it was hummable and all of that. And it was a strong song. But we had no idea that it would eventually become that sort of breakthrough song for us.
Well, how does it become the breakthrough song?
In part because at the same time you have MTV is starting to show videos, and we made some videos.
No, whoa, a little bit slower.
Yeah.
So you have a deal. You have a deal with CBS, which at some point becomes Sony.
Yeah.
But this is before that, and you make Diesel and Dust.
Yes.
Is it put out simultaneously in the U.S. as it is in Australia?
Yes, no, the company's ready for
it.
Okay, yeah.
Who decides to make the video?
We do.
Okay. Yeah. And so, you know, the video ultimately gets airplay all over the world, whatever.
Yeah.
But how much money is spent on that video?
Well, Sony paid
you know, of course, you ultimately pay for it.
Exactly.
But they advance you the money.
Yeah. It was jointly agreed, you know. I think that we've always made our own videos and done our own artwork and all that stuff. The record company will come to the party and lend us, as you say, some money perhaps, depending on what the budget are. But we decided what we wanted to do. And we shot some of it here in Sydney and some of it out in the bush. And People had heard the record by that stage, and you know, obviously the A&R people and others were excited about it and thought, wow, you know, we've got some songs here that might get onto radio. That's important for them. At the time in the States, as I understand it, you probably know more about this than I. So this is what we gleaned. The Paola thing was starting to be, had risen up its head again.
Certainly on radio.
On radio. And it seemed like there was a little bit more openness for people just to play other music, and we started to get played on radio, and there were some big stations that started to run the song. And
so the radio play came before the video play?
I think so, yeah. But you know, to be honest, it's a bit of a blur to me, so I'm assuming it did, but I'm not 100% sure.
But at what point do you realize you're on the rocket ship here?
I think when we go back to play, and we'd been playing big clubs and colleges. And then our agent says to us, actually, we're playing amphitheatres and they've sold out. So we might even play some bigger places. But look, here's the thing for us. You know, for many musicians, they literally do have a kind of overnight success. And they're scratching themselves a bit, and then, you know, they can hang on to it or they build on it or whatever. From what I've been telling you, you know, we've been plugging away in a country on the other side of the world forever.
Right, exactly. Well, that's, you know, the old 10,000 hours.
Absolutely.
But, okay, you make the video. I mean, I'm on the other side of the ocean, but it starts to really blow up.
Yeah.
So at what point does Sony in New York say, or CBS in New York say, you got to come here, we're going to do this?
Yeah, no, they're saying it pretty quickly and fairly readily, and so away we go.
So what was it like?
Well, you know, it's one of those funny things. Everything starts to move that much more quickly when that happens in your career. And you will have talked to other artists like this.
Right.
You know, they'll say, I actually can't remember what happened between, you know,
right, 80, right,
81
right.
and 83 because, you know, we were going fast and furious. I mean, it's not, I can't not remember it because we were lying on our backs in some nightclub somewhere. It's just that we never based ourselves overseas. We always based ourselves in Australia. And we've always marched to the beat of our own drum. Plus, we're not that fussed about popular culture and whether we're in or out or who's who in the zoo. So for us, it was more a case of what can we get done while staying sane,
okay,
and remaining connected to home.
You go on the road. Yeah. Do you partake of the rock star lifestyle?
Not really. I mean, we're
no, you.
Oh, me. I don't know which part. But
let's start with the alcohol and the drugs.
No, that's not. I mean, we enjoy having a beer and a glass of wine and all of those things. And people will have, you know, had whatever interaction with recreational drugs as young kids and teenagers and young adults. But Midnight Oil's got a very strong work ethic. And we enjoy ourselves. I mean, our idea of partaking in the rock and roll lifestyle, we couldn't actually believe that when we played a show, there was a bottle of wine there in the green room. There was a rider. Wow. When we finished, someone would drive us into a car to a club where we could hear another band and we would sit around having a beer and talking to other musicians. I mean, that was heaven on a stick.
And what about sex?
Most of us are settled with our permanent girlfriends, wives.
So by time it hit,
yeah,
you already had your girlfriend.
Had kids. We're married.
Oh, really?
Yeah, most of us are married men. Yeah.
Okay.
With
this
children.
Is before the success and what's paying for that lifestyle.
Correct. Yeah.
And I mean, the music is enough money to make this all work?
Yeah, well, we worked hard, you know, and we did our own deals and we had a manager and an agent, people that shared our vision. I mean, we were the ultimate do-it-yourself outfit in some ways. We didn't have, you know, safety pins in our jeans, but we had that attitude. But also, we weren't ripped off by people. You know, we're thoughtful about what
okay,
we do.
Everybody is married. Are they still married to those people?
Three of us are, yeah.
Well, that's pretty good for rock and roll.
Yeah, it's not bad.
Okay, so you have this big success.
Yeah.
To what degree do you feel pressure you got to follow it up?
Well, the pressure's inevitably going to come simply because you're aware of it. And so Blue Sky Mining's the next record.
Right.
And there are a couple of songs on there that also were chart songs.
Yeah, but those were successful songs. But when you're sitting there in the studio and you know you've had a hit album, to what degree you say, I've got to write something, I'm worried about whether it's going to be a good video, a good... Not at all.
No, it's not in our dialogue. We don't think like that.
Okay. And if... Okay, so then you continue to have success. At what point do you get back into the politics?
I should qualify my last answer to you, Bob, when I said we don't think like that. Of course, when people are writing songs, they'll think about whether this is the kind of song that might get played on radio, because we're students of music and we're musicians, but it's not our predominant sort of thought. Our thinking space is always around what works for us. What is Midnight Oil? Is it going to fly or not? We don't really know. This one sounds like it might. Maybe it won't. It doesn't matter. Here it is. So that's how that works. Blue Sky Mine, well, we then have the career that sort of settles and then stagnates right. a bit, you know.
Making any money?
Yeah, doing okay.
Right.
Not heaps of money. And we give a fair bit away. You know, we've got our own charitable things happening. And, I mean, we're not saints. We look after ourselves. But we also like to support people.
So how do you get into the politics thing ultimately full time?
Well, by the early noughties, I think from my perspective at least, we reached the point where if we don't relocate and re-transform what we're doing, we're really going around in a kind of a circle, which for Midnight Oil is not healthy. And at that stage, I've done two terms as the ACF president. I've spent quite a bit of time in the National Parliament. I've been negotiating political deals and legislations and all those sorts of things. And I wasn't sure what I would do, but I thought I want to do more politics, whether it's in an NGO capacity or whether it's in a formal capacity. And as it turned out, it became a formal capacity. So I get invited to join the Labor Party, which is the equivalent of the Democrats here. And by a confluence of events, there's a seat which I can win if I stand for it. And so I say to the Oils, at that point, when I finished with the Oils at that stage in 2002, I hadn't decided on politics, although everyone thought it would happen, but I didn't know what would happen. Anyway, eventually it does happen, and I become a member of parliament. I get elected here to a seat here in Sydney, a place where we played a lot, where I went to uni. I had good close connections with the community, and my life changes completely for 10 years.
Okay. What does the band say about all this?
Look, mixed feelings, I think. Some would have liked to have us to kept on doing what we were doing, maybe with people doing solo albums and we regroup occasionally. Right. Others were like, yeah, that makes sense. You've always been that kind of person. So
you're doing the political thing for 10 years. What are they living on? What are they doing?
They just do different things. You know, well, it's funny. They thought they'd get another singer for a while. That proved a little
That's
difficult.
Right.
So they form a band. It ends up being an instrumental band called The Break, and they play arts festivals and around and about a bit. They do their own solo albums, both Jim and Rob. Yeah, prolific writers, so there's lots of music coming out. Jim produces people, and they play with other people. So they live the life of working musicians in
Sydney. Okay, they got to be pissed at you.
Yes and no, I think. I don't know. I mean, we've talked about it a bit. The attitude seems to be, hey, you know, you've got to, you're not the kind of person we can hold back.
Okay. What about in your mind? You're leaving the circus. Are you cool with that?
Yes, very much so.
Okay. You go into politics. Now at the end of it.
Yeah.
Okay. What do you think about it?
Of having been in politics?
Yes.
Did not regret it for a second.
Well, you have an experience, but to what degree were your goals fulfilled?
Some goals were fulfilled to the extent that I hoped for, and others fell short. My major feeling about it, Bob, is that I probably should have done it earlier.
And what would have happened if you'd done it earlier?
I think if I'd done it earlier, I may have had a longer career and maybe even a more senior career, even though I was a cabinet minister. I was very senior by the end. So, for example, I'm very interested in foreign affairs. So perhaps, you know, that I might have ended up as the Minister for Foreign Affairs if I had started earlier.
So how does it end?
Well, we have a leader at the time. He's the Prime Minister. I'm the Environment Minister under him, but he's a difficult person to be led. I only ever had one boss. One was enough. But he's then replaced by a woman leader who becomes Australia's first female Prime Minister, Julia Gillard. When that changeover happens, she gives me all of her portfolios, or most of them. So I become the education minister, and I work as the education minister and the youth minister, and we pass laws to improve education. But the party's not travelling well in the polls, and he, the first prime minister, stages a comeback. And I privately decide if he comes back, I'm not staying. So he comes back and I say to my colleagues, okay, that's it. They want me to stay and stay in that role, but I resign from that role. And then when the next election comes, I don't stand again.
What was the thought? I mean, you know, what were you planning to do if you were no longer having that career?
Well, I could do anything. You know, I could spend some time with my dearly beloved wife, you know, and she's been hanging in for me for a long time because I've obviously been working really hard and long hours and all of those things. I understand how the country works. I've had a lot of experience, you know, at big levels of government. I've been an activist. Now, I can add value to someone.
Okay, so once you don't stand for re-election, at what point do you say, fuck, we'll get the band together?
Well, that's the good question, isn't it? So I thought I'd be working essentially as a lawyer come activist with community groups.
Right.
That's what I thought I'd be doing. And playing a bit of music on the side, you know?
Right.
I thought, yeah, we'll play in a club and we'll raise a bit of money, you know, for whatever and have some fun. But I finish, and then as I wrote my autobiography, and as I'm writing my biography, there's a guitar sitting in the corner of my study. And I'm an average guitarist, but I can play the guitar and I'm a musician, so I know the chords. And this guitar is, you know, it's starting to move. And it's quite weird. And I'm thinking, am I seeing things? It's not really moving, but it's calling me. Pick me up, you know. So I start picking the guitar up. At the end of each day, I'd try and write 800 words. You know what it's like. And then I'd pick up the guitar and I'm just playing some simple chords and I end up with a dozen or so what I call folk songs. So I played these folk songs just like a 16-year-old. You know,
right.
I've got a few folks because I've always been in a band with people who are great songwriters,
right.
And they're always writing songs and playing guitar. Oh, you should record the songs. Have some fun. So inevitably I do go and record those songs with Martin Rossi from Midnight Oil, but with other people as well. We turn them into electric folk songs. And I loved it. You know, I just re-encountered that part of my life, which makes me feel good. And in doing that, Martin and I were chatting. And of course, we said, well, it'd be interesting to see what happened if we got in a room together. Shall we do it? And I said to the Oils, do you want to get in a room together? Because I've loved making music by myself. A little different when you're back with your colleagues again. With the promise that we made to one another, which we weren't going to break, get in the room. And if everybody doesn't feel literally as a older musician who's been around the block 90 times that we're blowing one another's heads off, then you've got to walk out the door. But as it turned out, it sounded alarmingly better than I remembered. And we thought, well, let's play some shows. And it was literally little steps like that ended up to today.
Okay. So what year do you stop running for re-election?
2012. 13.
Okay. And at what point do you start writing your autobiography?
Straight away.
Okay. So you really never did all these other things working for whatever. You went straight to the autobiography. Okay. So then you're in the room together. You play the small shows. At what point do you say, fuck, we're going to give it a run?
Pretty much straight away. Yeah. Pretty much straight away. I think there's no point in doing it half-heartedly. And there's only one way of testing it, you know, is to see if people are there. And I think the challenge, of course, is the one that you don't want to be a nostalgia act. You don't want to be past your best. Physically, you're obviously not as young as you were. So what is it that makes it work? Well, for us, it's always been about the sound that we're creating on the stage. Is that still going to happen? We got new management who shared the vision. We played here a little bit and people went beyond bananas. It was a little bit, whoa, okay. And so you could feel the lightning, but really, well, let's go and play in the world and see if there's anyone there.
But this was a really big deal, okay? Because I would hear from people literally from Canada, literally in the U.S., you got to go, you got to go. And I, you know, this was such a big deal, okay? And the reviews were great, whatever. You come back from that tour, now what?
Well, we've got to make some music. So, yeah, we've started writing and recording, and we'll do that.
And, Co, if you went back on the road, where can you play? Where does Midnight Oil mean something? Pretty much everywhere, or just Australia, United States, Canada?
Oh, no, we could play South America, Brazil, Europe, Scandinavian countries.
And on this last tour, did you go to all those places?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, we did. We played most of them.
And was it lucrative?
In some ways, in some places, it certainly paid for itself and better.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the political thing. Okay. What did you learn about the process?
It's a little bit like making sausages. You don't want to get too close to it, you know, if you've got high ideals about it. But on the other hand, it's the most important game in town.
Okay, but to what degree, by making the sausage, does it taint the individual? To what degree do you have to compromise?
Well, the definition of politics is compromise. There is nothing happens politically, even the big steps in this world, without someone somewhere compromising to some extent. The question around that is always, are you compromising the very thing that you're standing for, or are you ultimately advancing it? And I think 9 times out of 10, my view is that within the party, we were always advancing it. If there were things that you didn't agree with, which essentially is a compromise for you, that is part of the process of being a team player in a political party in the Westminster system. One of the things that holds us back politically as a species are people's egos and people's lust for power and the fact that they'll do anything for it and the fact that they don't support their colleagues for the greater good. And one of the things that I did when I went into politics was I eschewed the fact that I was really a very well-known national person in Australia, celebrity if you like.
Right.
Not my word, but probably definitely the most famous person ever to walk into the parliament just like that.
Right.
And anyone who's tried that before, whether it's been a football player or a sports star or someone, has got smashed out of the park.
Right.
And I wasn't going to, you know, show up on the weekend shows and crack jokes about midnight oil and, you know, we played a big set and now the legislation is done. I did it as a serious politician. And a lot of people here didn't quite figure that out to begin with, including my peers, couldn't quite understand that. But I felt that the midnight oil was too important for me to demean them in any way by using them. And I also felt that politics is too serious as a vocation to try and utilize show business to advance it. So I was a classic policy wonk. I'm the boring guy that reads everything, you know, and wants to get it done.
Okay. So what was it like when people thought you compromised and got angry at you? I'm talking about constituents.
Mostly predictable, all par for the course. And
but could you cope with it?
Oh, yeah. No, of course. Yeah, no.
Okay. And then what, you know, you were Minister of Education and Youth. In a perfect world, what would you like the educational system to be?
Well, as it should be in your country, you know, and I went to your country. I spent time with the education secretary there, Obama's education secretary, and I just can't remember the guy's name, but you know, trying to do good stuff. So here's the deal. Essentially, unless we have well-rounded citizens emerging in our countries who've got the capacity to innovate, to empathize, to be creative, who've got a decent knowledge base, and who understand a bit about history, the world will be messy. In order to do that, you have to maximise the opportunity for any young boy or girl, whether they're living in the suburbs of Connecticut or they're out in the middle of wherever, and no matter how much money their parents or carers own, to be the best student they can be. So we've got a bell curve in our populations in America, and we've got a bell curve in Australia. You want to make sure everybody gets the best opportunity, but your bell curve kids are the ones who become the scientists, the designers, the leaders of the future. To do that, you have to make sure that every school is adequately resourced to do that job, the teachers are well trained and well remunerated, and that the leaders in the schools, principals or headmasters or mistresses, whatever you call them in your country, have got the capacity to lead. And in our country, that means that everyone should get supported in education funding from the big budget according to need. Not the loudest voices, not the richest schools, according to need. And these other principles apply. If you think about when you and I went to school, and some people listening to this compared to my kids and then their kids, you don't need to be a brain in maths to be able to add up. You've got a pocket calculator. Nowadays, you've got a computer. You don't need to be told how the world actually fits together in terms of geography because you can ask Madam Google and Madam Google will enlighten you. But how do you become a well-rounded citizen? How do you become someone who learns to listen, who understands problem solving, who realizes the gaps in their own knowledge and then goes off and makes sure that they fill those gaps to do something with them, who's imbued with a sense of concern for their fellow people? You can only do that by a good education system in the primary level. And if you look at a country that does it well, Finland is the example, but there are others. That's what they do. And they don't do it. They don't work harder. The kids aren't in class longer than they are in Australia or the States. They're not, you know, being coached at home by tutors more than other people are at all. Their teachers are well remunerated, effectively their masters of education, and the schools are well supported. That's what you've got to do.
Okay, but in the United States, first reaction to what you're saying is, who's going to pay for all this?
Yeah, well, guess what? Everybody should pay, including the wealthy. Everybody should play, including the big companies.
You're preaching to the converted here.
Yeah, I know.
But just, you know, looking at the thing, I mean, in America, tax is a dirty word.
Yeah.
You can't even mention it.
No.
It's a third rail topic.
Yeah.
So, okay, so what is the hope for the world?
Well, I can't talk about the hope for the world. The hope for America is it's got to get over its allergy to tax. You know, there's got to be a reconfiguration of language to enable that to happen.
Okay, culture, well, let me be more specific and broad at the same time.
Yeah,
we have all these nationalistic people around the world, primarily a reaction to income inequality and globalization.
Absolutely,
you and me know that globalization is inevitable.
Totally,
you don't want to make a flat screen in your home. No one wants to pay $3,000 for a flat screen. But we can also say that the people who were left behind from globalization didn't get any help.
Correct.
Okay. But is the world going to move more towards Brexit, more towards Trump, or is there going to be an event that flips us back to what once was in terms of globalization? What do you think?
Okay. So big question. But I think essentially that one component of nationalism, Trump and Brexit, which, if you like, previous social democratic and progressive forces haven't fully understood, is the tribal nature of communities and nations. And that unless we are clear about how we essentially mediate globalism locally, as opposed to, hey, just let it happen,
right,
people are going to be, then it's going to be a very contested space politically. Having said that, I think the most important awareness that we can have is the awareness that we got when NASA first sent people to the moon, you know, and we first saw the photos. And so it's simple. Sounds like a very simplistic thing to say, but the truth of it is that, you know, with 8.5 billion people and numbers growing, although eventually it'll stabilize off, and a world that where the ecology and the environment of the world is pretty much getting stretched to breaking point, we have to work out the cooperative mechanisms for allowing us to have national and international responses to these issues, which are coherent and can work hand in hand. And that is essentially the vision that they had after World War II when they set up the United Nations. And that vision was, we cannot have a global war. Now the vision must be, we must have absolute global cooperation whilst maintaining the sanctity of communities, local communities, regional communities, and nation states to chart their own course within these much more broadly agreed parameters. And the obvious one around here, Bob, is climate change, because it's the ultimate economic issue, but it's also the ultimate global issue, and it's the ultimate environment issue. It affects us all. And no rich person, you know, living in your state or this city who thinks they can escape it by having a better air conditioning system and a walled estate is going to escape. It's not going to happen.
Okay. Where does music fit in with all this?
Well, music's our soundtrack, you know. Music's the soundtrack of our time, of the zeitgeist, of whatever's happening at the moment. It's not necessarily going to lead the charge. Music doesn't change the world by itself. It can't. People do it. It's people that change the world, but they need their songs. They've got to have their songs. They've got to have their soundtracks. So I think that music has not even a role to play. I think it does its thing in a most magical way. It crosses, if you like, the mind to the heart barriers very quickly. It goes straight to both, and then it goes to your feet as well. What could be better? That's what you need.
Okay, so you've achieved so much. You've had an internationally successful group that didn't sell out. You had a political career. What is the next dream?
Well, I just hope to be able to do each day well, you know, and I think this is honestly, I'm not trying to be falsely modest, but I really do think that one of the mistakes that is easily made, particularly in this profession, is to believe that you have the answers and that you're the hero, you know. I don't buy the hero myth, you know. I think it's been a really dangerous myth for Western civilization. I buy the collective myth. Together, working together, using our different skills and capacities and ability, we can get good stuff done. So I'll just continue to do that with my music friends and with anyone else who wants to do it.
Okay. Did you have that same viewpoint before you got involved in politics, or did you learn it as a result
No,
of being-
I had the same view before I got involved in politics. My views haven't changed much over the last 30 years.
Okay. So much food for thought. Peter Garrett, certainly politician, lead singer, charismatic. Thanks so much for doing this.
Well, Bob, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, mate.
Okay, great. I have so much more to learn. Till next time, this is Bob Lefsetz.
The hit movie Bob Marley, One Love, is now streaming on Paramount Plus. Celebrate the life and music of an icon who inspired generations through his message of love, peace, and unity. If you missed Bob Marley, One Love in the theaters, now's your chance to watch at home. Stream the hit movie now on Paramount Plus, rated PG-13. Head to ParamountPlus.com/One Love to try it free. Now,
whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cash back on purchases. And pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.